From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new political era. We'll ask James Fallows to share his hopes for and reservations about President-elect Bill Clinton. James Fallows is Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. Also today, what's it like when an old friend becomes president? We'll talk with Robert Reich, who's been friends with Clinton since they were Rhodes Scholars at Oxford. Now Reich is a Harvard political economist and a senior advisor to the Clinton campaign. And we check back with conservative political columnist and former Nixon speechwriter William Safire. When we last spoke, he was thinking the unthinkable. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush returned to the White House today after being soundly defeated yesterday by Governor Bill Clinton. Mr. Bush asked a gathering of well-wishers and staff on the South Lawn to help him finish the job with style. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Mr. Bush returned to Washington, D.C. to a warm but teary welcome by administration officials, members of Congress, and White House staff. The president's remarks were brief, and he said to those who wouldn't stop cheering, maybe you didn't read the election returns. It didn't turn out quite the way we thought it would.
I am very grateful to all of you. It's been a wonderful 4 years, and nobody can take that away from any of us. It's been good and strong, and I think we've really contributed something to the country, and maybe history will record it that way. Thank you all very, very much.
The president's advisors were still trying to figure out what went wrong today. Pollster Robert Teeter said the timing of a second indictment in the Iran-Contra arms for hostages deal stopped the president's rise in the polls. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater was also asked what happened. The other guy got more votes, he said, and he left it at that. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
President-elect Bill Clinton moved today to reassure world leaders and American business that the transfer of power will be smooth and his policies will aim to maintain stability. Clinton expressed his support for President Bush during the president's final months in office, reminding friends and enemies alike that America's foreign policy remains solely in Mr. Bush's hands. Clinton also sought to prevent any panicky reaction on Wall Street by saying that he understands the need for stability as his administration works for change. Women made big gains in the Senate last night. Come January, there'll be a total of 6 women in the U.S. Senate. 2 of them, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, are from California. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Though their races and their opponents were very different, their campaign theme was the same: change. Change the direction of the economy and change the makeup of the U.S. Senate. The 2 Democratic women brought enormous enthusiasm for the Democratic ticket in the state, but at the same time, Bill Clinton's big win over President Bush helped them to a precedent-setting victory. Congresswoman Barbara Boxer endured a bruising campaign. Her opponent, conservative Bruce Hershenson, painted her as a check-bouncing, big-spending liberal. Feinstein, the former mayor of San Francisco, had a much easier race, handily beating the appointed incumbent Republican John Seymour. Feinstein will serve the remainder of a term that expires in 1994. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 29 points to close at 3,223. Declines led advances by a margin of about 10-7 in heavy trading of about 194 million shares. This is NPR News. Serbian forces pressed their offensive in Bosnia today, attacking towns in the dwindling government-held territory north of Sarajevo. Bosnia's Muslim-led government controls only about a half dozen cities and towns. A French UN peacekeeper was wounded today in a brief firefight that erupted at the Sarajevo airport. British Prime Minister John Major's political troubles continue. Tonight, he narrowly avoided a defeat in the House of Commons vote on the Maastricht Treaty on Greater European Union. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
On the surface, the vote was a simple procedural motion saying that the House of Commons would resume discussions about the Maastricht Treaty, but it masked a different political agenda. Prime Minister John Major's credibility has been undermined recently by the collapse of the pound and the announcement that 31,000 miners would lose their jobs. His political weakness has led to an upsurge in activity by the anti-Maastricht forces in the Conservative Party. By winning this vote, Major hoped to reassert his control over his party. But the opposition Labour Party, which is committed to Maastricht, decided to turn the motion into a confidence vote on John Major. They joined with Tory rebels, and these unlikely bedfellows came within 3 votes of defeating Major's motion. And observers say the split in his party will continue to undermine the Prime Minister's ability to govern effectively. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The United States and the European Community have taken their farm trade dispute to the World Trade Organization. After talks on farm subsidies broke down yesterday in Chicago, the United States asked the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, to approve U.S. sanctions against EC food imports. Deputy U.S. Trade Ambassador Rufus Yerxa said the proposed tariffs would cover about $1 billion worth of food products that the EC sells to the United States. The EC said it would block the approval of the U.S. request. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're all testing out what it feels like to say President Bill Clinton. We asked James Fallows to share some of his thoughts about our president-elect. Fallows is the Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. He's completing a book about the rise of Asian economies. And he was part of the previous Democratic administration. He was President Carter's chief speechwriter. Fallows spoke with us earlier today from his home in Washington, D.C. I asked him about his hopes for the Clinton administration and his reservations about it. Let's start with his hopes.
My main hope for what Bill Clinton might do as president rests on the fact that I think what he cares about most is what, in my view, most needs doing in this country, which is to pay some attention to both the economic fundamentals of how we earn our way and kind of the social comity, the sense of everybody being part of one family. I think Ross Perot, to his credit, was talking about both those things, too. George Bush, I think the battles of his generation were different battles than those, but I think these are the battles of Bill Clinton's generation, and I think he cares about them. And so the best analogy and the most hopeful analogy I might use is that of Franklin Roosevelt when he came in early 1933. Certainly the situation is different in that it is not the Great Depression and the world is not heading off the cliff, but there is this similarity, I think. You could argue that Bill Clinton does not know now exactly what he wants to do about the economy, about manufacturing competitiveness, about the welfare system, about health care, about whatever, but he knows he wants to do something. And similarly, Franklin Roosevelt didn't know what he wanted to do about the Depression, but he knew that he had to do something. And so there was a lot of experimentation, some blind alleys, but in the end, they did do something. And I think Clinton will have, for better and worse, the same impulse to do something, and that, on balance, I think would be good for the country.
Your reservations?
Reservation, I guess, has to do with parts of his nature and part of the Democratic Party's nature. On the personal front, Clinton's very strength could have as its other side his weakness. He seems to be a man of enormous appetites and ambitions and energies. He's brought himself from Hope, Arkansas to the presidency at the age of 46, and he has willed his way through terrible troubles. And it is very rare to find that kind of personality as a completely positive package. Often there are some surprising little time bombs buried within it. I don't know what they might be. It may be that he's been so tried in the last year of campaigning that all the bad parts have been boiled out, but we'll see. And I should say also that to Clinton's credit, as a matter of temperament, both Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter as Southerners seem to be constantly tormented by the idea that the pointy heads were looking down at them, that the Ivy Leaguers were sort of sneering at them. Clinton seems to have none of that impulse at all, even when George Bush was ridiculing him time and again for his tiny state background. The other reservation has to do with the Democratic Party and how it will respond to the world we're in right now. Clinton, even in his exultation at this moment, may feel a little bit sober to realize that now he has to actually do something about the economy. Now he has to actually do something about the federal budget deficit. And if there were easy ways to do that, somebody would have done them by now. And so the question is whether it's possible for him to kind of rouse people to the efforts that are needed to deal with these problems.
Clinton has promised to include Republicans who are willing to roll up their sleeves and work for change. How unconventional a promise is that?
John Kennedy did the same thing when he came in, and it's just smart politics. There is a natural tendency to want to rub salt in all of your opponent's new wounds and just kind of cackle at their agony. This is a temptation I strongly understand and felt very overwhelmingly when James Baker came on the screen last night. But it was interesting that as soon as George Bush lost this campaign, the good Bush came back, and he was talking about doing what's right for the nation, and Clinton very shrewdly responded in exactly the same tone, because he has everything to gain by trying to bring more people into his tent. Again, the person who seems most similar to him, in my mind, in our recent political memory, is Lyndon Johnson, the sense of wanting, where his basic impulse is to get people into the tent, wanting people to be in his family, wanting people to be around him. In Johnson, there seemed to be a kind of edge of craziness or darkness that went with that we haven't yet seen in Clinton, but that's the impulse that seems most similar to me.
What do you think is happening in the Republican Party about now?
Well, what's been happening among my Republican friends for the last two or three weeks is basically people looking for work, and looking for work, and yet even more actively than that, deflecting blame, concocting all these theories about, gee, if only they'd done this or that. I have some firsthand experience here. All of us who were associated with the Carter administration became very proficient at a sort of explaining why it all could have been saved if only they had listened to us. If only they'd listened to the right advisors, then things would not have gone off the cliff. And that's, I think, the main activity today.
Right. As either Clinton or Gore pointed out in their speeches last night, and I wrote this down and neglected to take note of which said it, and now I don't remember, but one of them said that for the first time in the White House, there's a generation of leaders born after World War II. As someone who is part of the same generation that Clinton and Gore are, what do you think the significance of that is?
Well, horrifying and yet true to realize that we already were halfway there in the Bush-Quayle administration. Quayle was also, I think he's about the same age as, he's between Clinton's and Gore's age. But having the whole ticket that way has, I think, it has one sort of chastening effect to those of us who are their contemporaries. You think, well, gee, you know, if I'd been living my life correctly, I could have
<That's right. laughs>
I could have made something of myself, too. And you do remember these people from your youth. And Al Gore was roughly a contemporary of mine in college. And so you think, gee, somebody I knew is actually running things. How safe can we be? But on the high road, I think there are two things they can bring. One is they simply are, they have more oomph and more energy than someone their father's generation does. I never approved of these endless pictures of Clinton jogging. I don't think that's an aesthetically pleasing sight. But I think the implied message there was that here is somebody with pep. Here's somebody who thinks that his life challenges are still ahead. Also, these are people who don't think that their main life's work is either beating the Germans and Japanese in World War II or beating the Russians after World War II, those being the two main challenges of George Bush's lifetime. And so they've come of age where kind of the plot line of their generation is one of decline from some golden past. And their challenge as adults is to find ways to reverse the decline, real or perceived. And so I think that does attune them to what needs doing now. But I may just be saying that because I'm their age.
I thought this campaign, in a way, played a final reprise of old generation gap themes like the draft, being against the war in Vietnam, did you smoke marijuana, what does that mean? In a way, I think this really might be the final reprise of that in a political campaign.
It's interesting to me that there are basically three of those leftover generational cleavages, and I think they're resolved and unresolved in different ways. One of them is the did you smoke pot cleavage, and basically that seems to have no mileage to it at all anymore. I don't think anyone really cares about that, and Clinton's only mistake was not preemptively disclosing this a couple of years ago, as Gore and many others did. A second one, which probably will be with us in the longest term of all, is that about the changing role of women. And this is basically why Hillary Clinton had to be put in the closet during the last couple of months of the campaign, because this is sort of an ongoing cultural issue to resolve, both, you know, within any given generation and between generations. The one that seems most poisonous, especially among men of the Vietnam generation and between those men and their fathers, is, of course, what did you do in the war? And it seems to me that there is at least the potential for this election helping resolve that. The main grievance against Clinton is not so much that he didn't fight for his country, but that he seems so uncomfortable with the whole issue and wasn't able, so to speak, to come clean about it. I would think that during the campaign, he had every interest to kind of say as little as possible about the issue, because every time he brought it up, he was just sort of drawing attention to it. I would hope that sometime as president, he would reflect on this in a more expansive way and maybe help lay it to rest. But the very fact that he won, I think, should help lay this somewhat to rest, too.
What did you think of the way Bush handled the draft and the way Clinton tried to explain his own decisions?
I think the best interpretation of the trouble Clinton had is one that Charlie Peters, a friend of mine who's the editor of the Washington Monthly, wrote in his magazine a couple of months ago. And he said that basically what's going on here is that Clinton must not have forgiven himself for what he did in the war years. What Charlie meant by forgiving himself is that there was a certain picture that most people of my generation had in our minds growing up in the 50s and early 60s. Most of our fathers had been in World War II or in the Korean War. In the late 50s and early 60s, basically all men went into the military service. There was what was in effect a nearly universal draft. John Kennedy had been a wartime hero. And so there was the idea that this was a sort of manly thing to do. It was the natural stage in life's progression to be in uniform for your country. There was a kind of cognitive dissonance in the late 1960s where if you ended up thinking that you were against the Vietnam War and for some combination of ignoble and worthy motives you didn't want to go, you then had to sort of feel how you felt about yourself. The main reaction for people from that age was to try not to think about it later on, and because they felt uncomfortable with it. It didn't fit the view they had of what they wanted to be as men, how they wanted to live their lives, and so they tried to kind of cram the whole issue to one side. There are things that people should hold themselves accountable for, that they didn't put themselves more on the line, didn't formally refuse induction, et cetera, et cetera. But the point Charlie Peters was making is that Clinton hadn't really reckoned about what things he felt proud of in opposing the war in Vietnam, what things he felt uncomfortable about or even ashamed about, that he hadn't gone through this normal ritual of masculinity. And for that reason, he just tried to sort of shunt off the issue when it first came up, and then got into this terrible box of having to kind of salami slice his explanations and go through this endless rotzy fact-checking and people saying this, people saying that. The best thing that the draft issue brought out was the voice of many, many veterans, such as the two senators Kerry in the Senate, saying, look, we paid a price in Vietnam, a physical price, and we don't think it is worthy to try to divide the nation again on this issue. We don't hold this against Bill Clinton, et cetera, et cetera. That was the best thing it brought out, and it would be nice if at some point, with the election behind him, Clinton could again reflect on what he is proud of and what he is ashamed of in those years. Sensibly, he avoided doing that during the campaign, but he now has the luxury and, I would say, the obligation to go into it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Fallows. He's the Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine, and he's currently writing a book on the rise of Asian economies. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Fallows, Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. You interviewed Bill Clinton for a piece that was written for The Atlantic. What were your personal impressions of him?
First, at the just kind of gossip magazine level, he is both bigger and less athletic-seeming than you would think. When you see him and Gore together in photos, it looks like they're a kind of matched set, these two big, sort of burly people. I think they're very different physical types. Gore looks like an athlete who has gone a little bit to seed, but is still basically an athlete. Clinton, if you will forgive me, looks kind of like a fat boy, a guy who is just sort of big, and I think his lifetime battle is going to be with this... with physical shape. I may have the sort of the ectomorph's worldview in saying this, but that's one the main physical impression. He's just bigger than you expect. He's really he fills up the room. That's connected to a trait of personality. My strongest feeling in meeting him is that this was a person who was just born as a politician. Maybe it was genetic, maybe it was the particular way he was raised, but he has the natural gift of making you feel important, making you feel listened to, making you want to like him. People, since there's such a low regard for politicians in general, people are surprised to find when they meet them they're generally so charming. That's not a surprise. That's why people go into politics, because they are charming. He also is... as I think people have seen on TV, he is very smart in a kind of raw processing information way. That you ask him a question and he will give you a well-formed answer with lots of facts. There's one other detail that comes out, I think, when you meet him that doesn't come through as much on TV, which is there is a kind of wryness to him, a kind of edge that doesn't really come across. When he's on the camera, he generally seems to be worthy and earnest and sincere and not really to have that much of a self-mocking approach. When I got the feeling when we were talking to him for this interview that he was kind of aware of putting on a certain show, that he had a little bit of self-mockery, that he knew there was a kind of game of politics which he loved and which he's very good at, but that once we put down our pencils and turned off the tape recorders, he was talking a little more casually than he had been before. He's making little jokes, little wisecracks. And there hasn't been that much of him that's come across on TV yet.
Mm-hmm. In the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic, that you co-wrote for The Atlantic, you described him as being a mix of the A student and the Pole, the politician. Can you go into that mix a little bit?
What I was trying to say there is that I think there are two innate parts of his characteristic. One is that he, more than most people who know a lot about policy, he really loves politics. This is a guy from the mold of Lyndon Johnson, of Mayor Daley, of other machine politicians who are, Mayor Curley, other people who really like the doing of politics, meeting people, addressing crowds, putting deals together. And so I have the feeling that is one of his primal passions of getting the job done and dealing with the mechanics. At the same time, he is smart enough and has enough kind of smart friends and has spent enough time in worthy academic institutions that he prides himself on being, as he puts it, a policy wonk. He likes to have those six-point answers. He likes to have the 90-point programs and is proud of that, too. I think probably his greater gift is the Paul-type gift, but he's probably prouder of the policy wonk-type gift. And many times these two things come into sync with each other, and ideally they'd be completely in sync, as with Franklin Roosevelt. There are times, however, when they conflict. For example, Clinton, in his A student manifestation, knows that there should be a gasoline tax, and he knows there should be some control of Social Security. But the politician part of him knows that those are losing issues, and so he attacked Paul Tsongas, who was the kind of the pure A student, on both those issues. And it will be interesting to see which of those segments of him wins out.
And he's going to have advisors representing both sides of him on that, and they'll be at odds with each other.
Well, it'll be very interesting to think, say, of James Carville and Robert Reich in the same room.
What do you find interesting about that?
Well, that Carville is who I've never met, is portrayed as kind of this Louisiana swamp fox who knows how to just use the dagger to eviscerate any of his foes politically, whereas Reich, who I'm using as a shorthand for Clinton's policy advisors, has all the numbers and all the theories, and they seem to inhabit separate universes, except that they're both very close to Bill Clinton. And so he can combine them in his person, and it'll be interesting to see whether they can be combined in the long run in his administration.
Looking back on Clinton's political record, do you see him as a, quote, waffler, or as somebody who sees the nuances within things and so can say, listen, on the one hand, on the other hand?
I think the waffling charge was always inaccurate. He's been, rather than a waffler, he's been a deal maker and conciliator, that where he's after his defeat the first time, after his first term in Arkansas, he came back and, much like Michael Dukakis after his defeat, had a more nuanced and cautious version of what he wanted to do. I think he hasn't waffled on his basic goals at all in the almost 20 years he's been in public life. So the good side of that trait is that he is more likely to get things done with the Congress than, say, Jimmy Carter was with his purist approach. The bad side may be excessive willingness to compromise. The campaign suggests more good than bad because he was able to move towards a direction keeping everybody in one team, and he didn't give away too much. But we'll see whether the good or bad side of a compromising nature wins out.
You worked for the previous Democratic administration. Now that there's a new Democratic administration headed toward Washington, even though you're a journalist now, does part of you wish that you were back in politics again? Or are you glad to be outside looking in?
Part of me, yes, does. And the reason that I say that is that my theory is that journalists have and should exercise one free pass into government. I think it's good for journalists to have worked in government once just because you see things differently. For example, you don't believe in conspiracy theories if you worked in the government. You realize they can't be pulled off, and most things happen by accident rather than design. But I think you can't do it repeatedly and still be a journalist, so I don't have any interest in doing that again. But when there is a new beginning like this, I think anyone who's interested in politics feels a sort of yearning of thinking, gee, it would be fun to do that. Also, I was working for Carter when I was in my mid-20s, and I didn't... there's a lot more I know now that I didn't know then, so there's that part of me, too, yearns for it. On the other hand, one of the cruelest discoveries of my time of working for Carter is that unless you are really, really important in a government, unless you're one of the handful of people who really advises the president or really runs a big department, you have less influence over things from the inside than you often do from the outside. That what I could do writing speeches for President Carter was largely determined by what people wrote in newspaper columns, what they said on radio shows, what was on the TV. And so that is some consolation to me.
So how do you think Washington, D.C. is going to change now?
The real estate market will be the first barometer of change. And already two realtors I've known called me in the last day just wanting to make sure if I had any Democratic friends coming to town would put them in touch, because this is the long-awaited, the long-hoped-for revival in the real estate market. I think very much like Hollywood, I think the personality of Washington is very much like a dog as opposed to a cat, in that it goes instantly to its master and has kind of no restraint or shame. And so whoever seems to be like the master at this moment, everybody will come slavering to it. And that is interesting to observe.
Does this feel like a new era is about to start?
Yes, it does. Because, the people are different. It's a different kind of people who are coming in here, and the ideas are different too. Now, both these sound like kind of boilerplate things to say. What I mean is that one has been accustomed for a long time now to see a certain kind of Republican that was well captured in a recent Saturday Night Live skit. They said, well, it was a parody of a Republican ad where they had an Asian woman saying, I'm a Republican, and a black man saying, I'm a Republican, and a Hispanic woman saying, I'm a Republican. Then this chorus of faces saying, we're all Republicans. And you had 500 white male lawyers behind them. And that's been kind of the tone, which I think will change. And the basic ideas of what makes America strong, I think, are changing too. So, yeah, it feels like something is underfoot or underway.
Well, James Fallows, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
James Fallows is Washington editor of The Atlantic magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we reflect on the end of a political era with conservative political columnist and former Nixon speechwriter William Safire. When we last spoke, he was thinking the unthinkable, voting Democrat. We'll find out how it felt to actually do it. Also, what's it like when a longtime friend of yours becomes president of the United States? We talk with economist Robert Reich. He and Clinton have known each other for over 20 years. Reich is a Harvard political economist and was Clinton's senior advisor during the presidential campaign. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton broke with the past today and chose not to hold a day after the election news conference. Instead, the Arkansas governor gave a brief statement outside the governor's mansion in Little Rock. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
The candidate who ran on an agenda of change promised that there would not be too much of it today. He offered a message of continuity in foreign policy, telling America's allies that the greatest gesture of goodwill they could make would be to continue cooperating with President Bush during the transition. He offered similar reassurances to the business community.
Today I say to our financial and business leaders that although change is on the horizon, we understand the need to pursue stability even as we pursue new growth. The changes I seek will strengthen America's market systems, not weaken them.
Clinton is meeting with his transition team today. The team is made up of lawyers, lobbyists, academics, and Hill staffers. They have been mapping out the nuts and bolts of the transfer of power. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush went back to the White House late this afternoon, where he said again that he would work for a smooth transition to a new Clinton administration. Mr. Bush told supporters gathered in the White House lawn to finish the job with style, that government goes on. The president told well-wishers that it's been a wonderful 4 years, and no one can take that away. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has extended cautious congratulations to President-elect Bill Clinton. Brooke Gladstone reports from Moscow.
In his congratulatory telegram to Clinton, Yeltsin said that he hoped the new U.S. administration would continue active support of Russia's reforms, building the foundations of a market economy on the basis of democracy, legality, and human rights. A spokesman for the foreign ministry said Yeltsin looked forward to a meeting soon with the new American president. Anatoly Chubais, the man in charge of privatizing Russia's immense government-owned industries, says that he and Clinton both represent change and that they would find much common ground. But he also conceded that he was used to Mr. Bush and would miss him, a sentiment echoed by many officials here and non-officials too. According to a poll published by the newspaper Izvestia just before the election, 44% thought Mr. Bush would be best for Russia, 14% preferred Clinton, and 42% either didn't know or didn't care. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
A state judge in New York has impounded ballots in the race between incumbent Senator Alphonse D'Amato and Attorney General Robert Abrams. With 98% of the votes counted, D'Amato leads with just over 108,000 votes out of nearly 6 million. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 29 points to close at 3,223.04 on volume of 194 million shares. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Russian lawmakers have ratified the START Treaty to cut about one-third of U.S. and former Soviet missiles and bombers over the next 7 years. The U.S. Senate has adjourned without approving the treaty that was signed more than a year ago. The measure also has to be approved by two other states in the former Soviet Union. Ratification came in Moscow despite opponents who called it a gift on a silver platter to the next U.S. president and said that Russia does not have the money to dismantle its weapons. A study in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine reports that overweight adolescent boys face an increased risk of heart disease in middle age, even if they lose weight as adults. David Barron of member station WBUR has more.
Researchers at Tufts University studied what happened to 500 school children whose height and weight were tracked in the 1920s and 30s. The scientists found that the boys who were most overweight died of heart disease decades later at 2 to 3 times the rate of boys whose weight was considered close to ideal. Tufts researcher Aviva Must says the danger of being heavy as a teenager seemed to persist, even in men who slimmed down in adulthood.
The take-home message here is that we must emphasize the prevention of overweight for people of all ages and look for ways in which we can maintain ideal body weight.
Overweight girls in the study did not face an increased risk of heart disease as adults, but they were more likely to suffer from arthritis. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
Officials of the European Community have blocked U.S. efforts to gain approval to impose up to $1 billion worth of sanctions against Europe in an oil seed dispute. Officials had called on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade to approve the tariffs on EC food imports. However, one official told the Council that the EC would block such a move. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's the economy, stupid. That was one of the mottos of the Clinton campaign, a constant reminder to focus and refocus on the economy. Harvard political economist Robert Reich was a senior advisor to the Clinton campaign. He's the author of the book The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for the 21st Century, which sets out some of the principles that inform Clinton's economic thinking. Reich has been friends with Clinton since 1968, when they both went to Oxford as Rhodes Scholars. Clinton has said he will be his own economic czar, but during the campaign, Clinton got advice from several economic advisors who offered different prescriptions for reviving the economy.
The economic advisors to this campaign, and in general the staff overall, there was a great deal of compatibility, far less elbowing, far less turf fighting, much more of a sense of team spirit than I remember in any other campaign that I've been involved in. And I think that comes from the top, because Bill Clinton is someone who tries to achieve a degree of consensus, wants people to develop their own ideas, but defend them in a very rational and reasonable way. So while there was not total unanimity of opinion about everything, the advisors were united about some very basic fundamentals. Number one, you've got to bring the deficit down over 4 years. Number two, you've also got to increase public and private investment. And public investment includes the essentials: education, training, research and development, and roads and bridges and all those unglamorous things that hold us together as a society. The other thing that I think almost all advisors felt united about was the notion that we have to move from a military-based economy to a highly competitive commercial economy. And this is a great challenge over the next 4 or 8 or even 12 years, because we have so much of our entire industrial base tied up to the military.
Now, because the economy was such an important issue during the campaign and because so many people are hurting, there's going to be a lot of pressure for quick change. Do you think quick change is possible? And do you think there might even be problems with quick change in jeopardizing the long-term future? And third of all, do you think we're going to get really impatient if change doesn't happen soon?
Well, you know, that's precisely my point. These problems have been festering for so long. There's no magic bullet. Most of them require a great deal of patience. Most of them have a very, very long amount of time attached to coming up with a solution. Hopefully, and I say hopefully, a new administration will be able to lay a foundation, do some things that show the public that at least progress is being made, give the public more confidence, and again, public confidence is a big part of the problem. The public now is so resigned to many of these problems just simply getting worse. So much of the public has watched them get worse for so many years that you have a great deal of disengagement on the part of the public, a kind of resignation that is the enemy of real change. If you want to know what the enemy of change is in this country, it's resignation that you can't really have change. You've got to have the public behind it. A lot of this requires a great deal of work at the state and local levels. So ideally, Bill Clinton sets a direction, scores some small-scale victories initially that lay the foundation for a lot of work later on, and give people a feeling that things really are getting better, could get better, that everybody has a role to play.
Now, you and Bill Clinton have a relationship that goes back to the 60s. You met in 1968 when you were both at Oxford University. You were also together at Yale. Can I ask how you became close friends and what kinds of things you had in common?
Well, we really met on the pier in New York City as we were about to take a boat along with about 25 other Rhodes Scholars to Oxford. We were 22 years old and full of beans and eager and excited. We had not been out of the country, most of us ever, including Bill Clinton and me. And we went out on this boat. It was the SS United States. About a day out to sea, Terry, I discovered that I had made a dreadful mistake. I did not have my sea legs. In fact, I turned green, retired down to my little cabin, and thought I would die. There was a knock at my door soon after that, and there stood this big, gangling southerner who I had met very briefly on the pier, soup in one hand, chicken soup, and crackers in the other hand. And he said in a drawl that I wish I could imitate, but I can't, I understand you're not feeling too well. And much better than my grandmother could ever have done, he nursed me back to health. And that was the beginning of a conversation that we've been having during that nursing period for 24 years about everything from the economy and society and American society and culture to foreign policy to our families and even what we want to do with our lives.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you opposed the war in Vietnam and I think had a draft deferment. And I'm sure you spoke a lot with Bill Clinton at the time. He was deciding what to do about the draft. I wonder what you think of how that issue was handled by Clinton and by Bush during the campaign.
Not very well by either of them. I was there at the time. I know exactly what happened. Bill Clinton, when he came back to Oxford in the fall of 1969 for his second year, he had relinquished his ROTC deferment very clearly. He was nervous. He knew he was going to be, or thought that he was going to be drafted at any moment. In fact, he didn't even secure what we call digs, housing, for that second year. He slept on our floors, the other Rhodes Scholars who were there, expecting that at any time he'd be called up. So that the assumption that got somehow insinuated into the campaign that Bill Clinton knew he had pulled a fast one and knew he had got out of the draft was simply patently wrong on the basis of my experience and knowledge and the knowledge and experience of many others who were there at the time. I think he could have handled it better in terms of remembering more of the details, being more upfront with more of the details. I think, quite honestly, he didn't remember. I didn't remember. I mean, people reminded me of certain occurrences that occurred, certain things that happened in the 1969, in that era, I had no idea of. Somebody told me that during the course of the campaign that Bill Clinton had gone on an anti-Vietnam demonstration. And I was curious about that, and I said, "Are you absolutely sure?" And they said, "Oh, yes, I have a picture of that." He was demonstrating, and he said, this particular person, "I have a picture of you demonstrating as well." I said, "But I have no memory. I don't think I ever did demonstrate, did I?" And, "Oh, yes, here's the picture." And sure enough, there I was, 22 years old, with my little picket sign against the war, marching around Trafalgar Square.
You didn't remember being in that particular demonstration or at any demonstration?
I specifically had no memory of being in any demonstration in England. I mean, that may be a sign of early dementia. I mean, I am moving into middle age very quickly, but so is Bill Clinton.
My guest is Harvard political economist Robert Reich. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Reich. He's a Harvard political economist and has been an advisor to Bill Clinton. I'm curious what it feels like to you today to have a friend who will be the next president of the United States, a close friend.
I can't quite believe it, Terry. Well, you imagine what it would feel like. I mean, just conjure up in your mind a good friend of 24, 25 years and assume that that friend last night became the president-elect of the United States. It doesn't sink in. I honestly cannot believe it. Every once in a while, my wife and I turn to each other and we say, you know, Bill is going to become president.
Does it make you uncomfortable when people ask you about your relationship with him or ask you about the things that you remember him about, you know, from college? Because it's hard for me to imagine, you know, having a friend who's president. I have nothing to quite compare that to. But I think it would feel kind of awkward to you know, talk about a friend who's become such a public figure. So I wonder what that's been like for you now and also during the campaign, especially when, like, the character issue is such a big thing. Yeah. and friends of his were being questioned a lot.
Well, to some extent, it felt awkward at first. I felt that our friendship was, like most friendships, a private affair. It was a relationship that was privileged. I didn't want to share it with anybody else. But it became very clear that I had to. Partly in order to defend my friend from allegations that I knew were false, partly to fill in a picture where I knew that the picture that the other side was painting was simply wrong. And as I began talking, it became easier and easier. There's still elements of our friendship that are off bounds. I simply find them too personal, like any friendship. It's not that anything, I'm hiding anything. It's just that certain conversations about our lives and our hopes and our families don't belong on the public record. Bill Clinton stayed over at our house about a year ago when he was just before he had decided to run. My boys know him pretty well, and they woke him up in the morning and knocked on his door, and he allowed them to come in, and they woke him up, essentially. And one of my boys said last night, you know, Dad, we're probably the only kids in America, aside from his immediate family, to know what kind of underwear the next president of the United States wears. there's an odd blend of intimacy and publicness here that I can't quite deal with.
Right, right. So you'll be able to call him at the White House, I guess?
I don't think so. I'm. You know, that would be very intrusive. Once somebody becomes president, they move into a different realm of reality.
Right.
Old friends are old friends. I'm sure if he wanted to talk to me, that would be fine. I think it would be a little bit out of bounds for an old friend to call him in the Oval Office when he's sitting there worrying about affairs of state. Well, there's another problem. Again, consider one of your old friends becoming president. Do you call that person by their first name, or do you call that person Mr. or Ms. President?
Yeah. What are you going to do?
I don't know. It's going to be very odd. I think when I'm sitting with him alone, if I ever do have that occasion, it's going to be very difficult to say Mr. President after 24 years of calling him Bill. On the other hand, when I'm sitting with other people, I suppose I have to call him Mr. President.
Robert Reich, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, it was a pleasure.
Robert Reich is a Harvard political economist, a Clinton advisor, and the author of The Work of Nations. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what kind of reactions are you getting to President-elect Bill Clinton?
Well, we're having some analysis, a little sort of second-day look back at the race. Clinton, Bush, and Perot, the three candidates, have all appeared publicly today. We'll have reaction from Europe and Asia. We're going to do some very substantial analysis of why Clinton won and how Bush lost and where the Republican Party goes from here. And we're going to take a look at what happened in the Congress, where a tremendous number of women were elected to the House and Senate.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Where does the Democratic victory leave the Republican Party? We called conservative political columnist William Safire to find out what he thinks. Safire is a former speechwriter for Richard Nixon. A couple of weeks ago, Safire told us he was thinking the unthinkable. He was thinking of voting for Clinton. Did he actually do the unthinkable?
Yep, I revealed it. I said, although the New York Times columnists never endorse anybody, because that's against the rules, traditionally, anybody could tell who I was against, and then I went into a diatribe against the lying that came out of the Bush White House. So, yes, I went ahead and, for the first time in my life, took the jump and voted for a Democrat for president.
How did it feel?
Not great. I mean, there's nothing I plan to do again.
So, what are your hopes and what are your reservations about the Clinton administration?
Well, I hope they govern the way they campaigned. They knew what they were doing. They were generally centrist. They were not overly impressed by pressure groups. Whether it was organized labor or organized anything. And I think if they hew to that, if they act like a national government rather than a coalition of interests, they should be successful.
And your reservations?
I have a hunch that they're going to get jerked to the left, that they'll be pushed into stimulating the economy when it doesn't need it, by that I mean driving up inflation. And if they do that, that'll increase the deficit and louse things up for the next couple of years.
So what do you think is going on now within the Republican Party between the conservative and moderate wings?
We're going to have a Donnybrook, which is a fine thing. I mean, I remember after the 1964 debacle, we picked ourselves off the floor and say, okay, we can't do that again. And the hard right will clash with the reasonable right, and conservatives will split. And then I would hope within a couple of years start not coming back together, but at least talking to each other and having a good convention and a good primaries.
What do you think is the future of Lynn Martin, the labor secretary who really was on so many talk shows during this campaign? She was one of the chief spokespeople for the Bush campaign.
Well, there's possibly a future for her in television.
Do you think she'll have a future in the party?
It runs for something, yeah. She's been a congresswoman, and I think she ought to get back into looking to see what she can run for in Illinois.
What do you think James Baker's future is going to be?
I think he'll be on a lot of heavy corporate boards and go back to making money, and home should hold no horrors for him.
And what about Dan Quayle?
He has more of a future politically, but it's foggy now. I think he has to let himself spend a couple of years thinking and working and operating the private sector. And then... look, anybody who ever worked for Nixon, like as I do, has to believe in comebacks and redemptions. And I think Quayle will be a factor.
What do you think were some of the high and low points last night in the acceptance and concession speeches?
They sounded like acceptance speeches. They were that long. And it was as if they couldn't let go of campaigning. And you felt like plucking them on the sleeve and say, hey, you won. You forget it now. Say something nice about the other guys you did, and then don't launch into a stump speech. The stump is gone, and but they just couldn't resist. And as soon as they see the red light go on the camera, they start talking. And I think that's they have to discipline themselves a little bit.
I thought Gore's speech was especially well written. Do you have anything to say about his speech, or do you have any idea who wrote it?
Long. I don't know. I don't know any of the speech writers, but as they come to Washington, I hope to meet them and tell them all, shorten it up, fellas.
Much as I liked his speech, I thought the low point of the speech was the Great Ship USA, which I thought sounded alarmingly like the Good Ship Lollipop.
There's a Shirley Temple quality to that, yeah. But seriously, the greatest concession speech, I guess, was Adlai Stevenson's, where he referred back to Abraham Lincoln's story of the little boy who said, I'm too old to cry, and it hurts too much to laugh. And if George Bush had done something like that, I think it would have gone out better. But his concession was fairly gentlemanly and honorable and gracious. I only wish he didn't have to read it.
One of the issues you've been writing about for a long time is Iraqgate. And with President Bush leaving office, how do you think his exit will affect the investigations into Iraqgate and into the Iran-Contra affair?
I think what will happen, if he's smart, he'll tell his attorney general to seek the appointment of a special prosecutor before the December 15th deadline. If he does, then he goes to the courts, and the courts pick a special prosecutor, and then the thing gets taken out of politics and becomes a real investigation. If he doesn't do that, then one of two other things will happen. One, the Democratic House and Senate will pass a new special prosecutor's bill or independent counsel bill, which the president will sign. He's told me he would sign it, and he said it in no uncertain terms. Clinton did. And in that case, in February, there'll be a new special independent counsel appointed, and then that'll be off to the races. But I think if that is delayed that long, if Bush fails to act now, then what will happen is the Senate and the House will get together and appoint a select committee, a combined committee, to really do a job on this the way... remember the old Watergate days.
What did you think of the rhetoric of the last few days of the campaign in which President Bush was calling Al Gore ozone and calling Clinton and Gore bozos and saying my dog Millie knows more about foreign affairs than they do?
My feeling is that we mustn't get too hypersensitive in politics. Politics ain't beanbag, as Mr. Dooley said. And if you call somebody a couple of bozos, you call him a couple of clowns, because a bozo is a clown. And so what's so terrible about that? And my dog Millie knows more about foreign affairs. That's, I think, reasonable hyperbole. And to get on your high horse and suddenly take offense, and my goodness, he called me, that's silly.
So you wouldn't have recommended against it had Bush asked you your advice?
I would not have, no. He was in his Harry Truman mode, frankly, I think the candidacy was beyond saving, so at that point, if he felt it in his heart to say, I wouldn't have stopped him.
Can you give us a preview of what the column is that you're writing now?
It's about the way Republicans feel sad but not weepy about losing. And we are dry-eyed, and the column is about why we're that way. And read it.
I will.
Great.
Good. William Safire, you're on deadline. I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye. William Safire writes a political column for the New York Times and a language column for the Times Sunday Magazine. His latest book is called The First Dissident. It's about the Book of Job and contemporary politics. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Kezia Perlman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the great rock singers speaks. We'll talk with Neil Young. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.